Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Kelly Gates, and I'm in the Communication Department and the Science Studies program at UC San Diego in the United States.
In California.
In Southern California.
In Southern California. And it's a great privilege to speak to you, Kelly. Prof. Kelly, we've been friends for a quarter of a century.
Well, and I should say full disclosure that Toby Miller, our podcaster, is a mentor of mine and really responsible for my any success I've had in my career as an academic.
I love hearing that. In fact, can we just talk about me for the next 45 minutes? I'd be delighted. No, but in all seriousness, Prof, it's a real privilege to have you here. From back when we first met, I've always learnt from you. And that's true whether it's been in conversation or reading your publications over that long period. So, to begin, I wanted to ask you what's currently dynamizing, retarding, preoccupying, interesting you.
Okay, well, I have also always learned from you. And one of the things that is really currently dynamiting and interesting and preoccupying me is the what I will call the AI hype driven data center building boom. And that is, it's a project that I'm just, it's a paper that I'm writing in response to a couple of things. One immediate thing was an invitation to participate in a special issue of the Journal of Photography and Culture on the special topic of post-photographic intelligence after AI. And I assume I was asked to participate in that, which I was very grateful for the invitation, in order to bring to bear on that issue my research, my past research on facial recognition technology, on, you know, perhaps describing or getting around to the state of facial recognition after AI, we'll call it. But having worked on that project for a very long time, I wasn't necessarily interested in going that route. But one thing that I noticed and have begun to notice is and this is partly because my in-laws live in Northern Virginia, and Northern Virginia has the largest concentration of data centers and data center construction in the world. And so it's kind of impossible not to see when you're in Northern Virginia, places like Prince William County, the number of data centers that are being built right now, massive structures, and the transformation of that landscape into a industrial computing center. And there, you know, it's, I've been very much influenced by your work and works of others on greening the media and understanding the material environmental impact of, you know, of this, the internet, of our digital culture. And it just occurs to me, you know, I got this email at UCSD where I work maybe a month ago that was introducing us to the new, what they called Triton GPT. Triton is the mascot of UC San Diego. And Triton GPT will be this, you know, version that will be for faculty and staff. And they're launching it. And along with it was this kind of typical, very mystical image of digital immateriality, of somebody holding this kind of translucent cell phone that has this chat between a human and a bot, and the chat's texts are sort of floating off the translucent screen into the air, and it looks very mystical and magical. And I just, you know, I think that there is this persistent idea about digital immateriality and around the new AI, all of this hype about AI. And the reality is this massive speculative investment in this infrastructure that is reshaping the landscape of these areas where these data centers are being built. And they are massively taxing on the power grid. They're requiring the abandonment of renewable energy goals. And they are taxing the water resources. There are all kinds of interesting constituencies opposed to them in those, you know, in a not in my backyard sense for many of them, like Manassas Battlefield Trust in Northern Virginia. There's these Civil War battlefield parks. They're actually beautiful parks, but they're, you know, sacred sites to people who invested in battlefield preservation and as historic sites. And, you know, people who live in gated golf course communities and don't like it either, because they're literally sort of building these power lines through the, and they're butting up against these residential areas. It's really stunning to see it and it's very complicated, the set of interests that are there, and who's battling whom. So super interesting. And what I got interested in is just the coverage, minimal as it is, and the activists who are, there are environmental organizations as well that are very, in the area, very opposed to it. And they are attempting to kind of visualize the scale of what is going on, because, I mean, you can see it as you drive around. It's hard to miss the scale of it. But it's actually there. What I was very interested in now, is the use of drone photography to sort of visualize the scale of it. Okay, so drone photography is used by both the boosters of this development, organizations like the Virginia Economic Development Partnership. They have these beautified aesthetic images of these data centers surrounded by greenery and looking like they are in harmony with the environment. And then there are others taking images and trying to point out, you know, the scale of the, required generators. They have these enormous amounts of energy generation that they have their own generators. And in any case, the cooling systems, all of it, these things are massive industrial centers. And the AI is an industrial, it requires a scale of industrial operations that most people is completely invisible to most people. So I've gotten ignited by that. That's one thing, you know, so that's what I've been working on in the mornings for the last few weeks. But and I'm, you know, I'm happy to talk about other things too, but that I have a book that's out there with reviewers, and I just got the second reviewer report. So I'm just read that, and I'm very excited to move back into looking at that book and getting it done, because it's been a long time in the making.
Oh, that sounds like that was not a negative review.
No, it was a fantastic review, and the kind of perfect review that, not perfect, everything is, you know, but it was the kind of review that you just long to get, which is not a rubber stamp, this is amazing, and just publish it. Although that's nice, but more of like, this is really an important book and I love this, but here are all the things that you need to do to make it even better, that I suggest. And from someone who clearly gave it a lot of serious attention. And so I'm very excited to kind of sit with those comments. I don't think we get that often these days, or maybe ever, that kind of just really substantive engagement and help with our work that's so necessary to take it to the next level.
Wonderful. So this question of the visibility of these things interests me. In my experience in the past, when they were relatively empty shells, They just looked like buildings in construction, but with lots of more wires than you would otherwise see. I managed to sort of break into one and take lots of photos, all of which mysteriously disappeared. I still don't know how, but you know, if I were the Steve Bannon of the left, I wouldn't know exactly who did this. That would be to do with pizza delivery, Prof K, I'm telling you. But the other thing is that when I was a child and my parents moved to different cities and countries all the fucking time, I would look for or find my bearings via public buildings. The train station, the post office, the telephone exchange, the power place, the public school, without even knowing what these were. But they were big bricks and mortar things that, of course, were socialist, right? Socialization of risk. Of course, many of those things have been privatized or in some cases were private and then became public and so on, like, say, the train system in the United States. But they were tributes to socialism. The next big investment of public money in this kind of infrastructure is the data center. Even though it gets massive subvention, it's often privately owned and controlled, and also, in my experience, invisible. What you're describing to me is a new visibility that is both propagandistic and resistive. And the new visibility that you're describing that's resistive comes from, you know, people who don't want to pay rates taxes on their homes for children to go to public school. You know, they're sort of awful golf people that you were describing. I and this is one of those interesting social movements of the middle class and the upper middle class, right? Not in my neighborhood, not in my backyard, etc., it seems. And those two forces are making these things visible that I've always thought were destined to remain invisible to the public.
Yeah.
That's what he was describing, which is news to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they're visible to the people in these locations. I don't know. I mean, I do think there is some coverage of these issues. And interestingly, it's like more financial leading press that are covering them because of the amount of financial investment, like, or yeah, speculative investment. There are different, I don't know the whole landscape of this. It's kind of a new project for me, but there are different investment companies that are specializing in this, you know, data center investment. So that's happening. It's visible there, but I don't think I was talking to a friend, someone who's not an academic and totally outside my field, but someone who is a physician and very well educated. And I was telling them about this. We were just chatting and I was telling them about this project. They asked what I was doing. And I was talking about data centers and they said, "What's a data center?" While on the one hand I was like taken aback, I don't think that's an unusual response. I mean, most people have they're very black boxed. For most people, and you know, they're black boxed even in this kind of visualization because most people don't break into them and see what's inside. And even if you did, what would you see? You'd see a lot of computers, but would you know what they were doing? I mean, you'd see a lot of different components and wires. It might give you some insight to the kind of physical material backbone, or you know, the material quality of what is happening there, but you won't be able to see computation. You won't really know the connection, be able to see the connection between that and your cell phone. So it's a black box. I think there's limitations to what we can even learn by looking at the infrastructure. Certainly it's important. I'm not saying we can't learn anything, but I think it's Louisa Moore in her book, Cloud Ethics, where she sort of says, look, it's, you know, we're not going to learn much about algorithms by visualizing infrastructure in this way. we're not going to learn about their political influence on our lives and on our worlds. And so, I take that to heart too, as well. There's only so much we can learn, but I do think that they are, it is probably, I can only imagine that it's the scale of computing infrastructure required to fuel, like, AI chips or whatever the chips that fuel this more powerful form of computing actually take literally, they're more power hungry in terms of how much, you know, literal power they require. So that's requiring more and more computing infrastructure. And I guess inevitably you're going to see it. It's going to be more visible that way. And it's also going to make people who are in those areas more likely to, you know, who have in some ways louder voices or more space, they get to take up more space. Yeah, I don't think they're the only ones who are calling attention to it, obviously, but it's interesting to see, like, when I started seeing signs all around about, you know, opposition to these data centers. And I think the Manassas Battlefield Trust is suing, you know, they're suing to block this massive data center alley that's proposed for, and it's right along the battlefield park, and it would just sort of ruin the sight line, basically, because you just see this one big cement warehouse after another of these things. So everybody has different reasons to be opposed, or overlapping reasons. But yeah, the visibility of it, I think, interests me. Like, and it, you know, that aligns with, I'm influenced, motivated, inspired by Lisa Park's work on visualizing infrastructure as a kind of project that helps us understand it better, but also understanding the limitations of just what looking at it can tell us. It's not going to tell us everything we need to know. We also need to do political and economic analysis, and the kind of analysis that is done by people who have the maybe more expertise or background in computer science itself, who can help explain the way AI happens at scale and what it's actually doing. You know, what actually happens when you generate image, when you use a generative AI application with, you know, whether it's an image generator or a text generator. I mean, I just really hate calling it AI. I feel like these things are text, they're massive text generators. They're massive image generators. They create composite images. It's really not that, you know, resist the urge to be impressed, as our, I forget exactly who said that, but some linguist who's doing a good job of, you know, taking to tasks some of the claims being made about ChatGPT. Yeah, I mean, you know, I've been working for a long time on this, you know, book, which is really very much about police video and the video in the legal system. But I repeatedly have to remind myself that for me, public enemy number one is actually not the police. It's really the tech companies. So.
And what did you say when your friend asked you, what's a data center?
Oh, that's interesting that you asked that. I pulled out my phone and I got an image up of a data center to show them what that looked like. And that image that I showed is one of my favorite images. And this is a kind of interesting story too, because I was teaching a course, an undergraduate large lecture introductory course called Communication Institutions and Power, that all of our undergraduates in communication at UCSD have to take. And I was looking for an image for this first lecture, like the first slide of the first lecture, that could kind of embody communications institutions in power in a kind of very contemporary way and capture their imagination. So naturally I turned to Google and Google image search, and I put Google data centers in the search bar, and it, amongst the results was an aerial image of a Google data center in South Carolina. And it was accompanying a article in a local or newspaper that was addressing the politics of water that were being implicated by that new. It was not just like one building. I mean, it's a campus of buildings. It's an enormous sprawling site. And that was built or maybe finished. It was actually not quite finished. You can see in the image, it's not quite finished. One of the buildings is still under construction. There's a construction sort of, you know, there are trailers and things still there. And, but some of it was finished and the, and Google was, you know, needing a lot more groundwater, like massive hundreds of millions of gallons of groundwater to, for the cooling systems of that thing. And the local, you know, their local water supplies were already taxed. And so it was implicating all this local politics over the water. And that's the article. So the image accompanied that, but the image is a really a kind of stunning, striking image of this data complex of buildings that is a data center in surrounded by greenery, surrounded by like bucolic looking farms. You can see them on the edges of the, around the perimeter of the data campus there, data center campus. And so I used that image and I decided like, I'm not going to tell. I used that image to show my friend who was like, what's a data center? I'm like, this is what a data center is. This is behind your, you know, when you use your cell phone to, you know, look at Instagram or whatever you do, your telemedicine, I don't know, but this is the backbone. But I showed my students in this large lecture, there were about 300 and some of the students in the class. And I decided I wasn't going to just tell them what it was. I was going to ask them what it was and to get some guesses. And, you know, maybe some people knew, not everyone spoke up, but those who spoke up didn't know when got it right. And the closest they came, someone said warehouses. I'm like, well, they are, you know, data centers are like warehouses. They're not exactly like other warehouses. They are a type of warehouse. But then the most interesting answer was a prison. So that got me thinking, wow, this does look like a sprawling prison complex. This looks like a mega prison. And that made me sort of want to look at, and I did, it reminded me of another moment when I was, recently I had to, well, I went back to my alma mater, my undergrad alma mater of Penn State University, and in between Penn State University and, Bellefonte, which is a town outside of State College, Pennsylvania, where Penn State University is located, there's a long stretch of highway to get to Bellefonte. And on that stretch of highway is a state penitentiary, Rockview State Penitentiary. I think it's Rockview. Anyway, the time I used to drive that way. There was a rock quarry. We went there. We used to drive past there. And it was this, you could see it out there in the distance. As more recently I went out there and we were driving by, I saw that it had expanded enormously, like the amount of, coverage, and the architectural style was slightly different. The old prison looked, you know, a certain architectural style, kind of Romanesque or something. And then the very utilitarian looking expanded part looked like pretty indistinguishable from Google data centers. If you were not really looking closely at the different components of it. I later learned that that's actually an entirely separate prison. But it's on the same site. So anyway, I thought that the prison answer was really clever. And it did remind me, and you know, it definitely made me want to think about this further, because this land use question, I mean, Ruth Wilson Gilmore's book, Golden Gulag, that looks at the expansion of prison construction in California, and the unprecedented expansion of that, and the politics of how that happened, I think would provide a really interesting basis of comparison for understanding the politics, or, you know, contrasting and comparing with the politics of data center expansion. Very different, but also, you know, interesting in their differences and also the similarities. So, yeah.
That is fascinating. Yes, it
It's always great to draw on the knowledge of large numbers of students, because even when it might not be the same knowledge as yours, it leads in interesting directions, doesn't it? That example.
Often. And
not wanting you to spill the beans on the new book, Police Video, I think you said it about, but thinking about how that connects to your earlier work, I wonder if we could take you back, as they say in baseball commentary, to your first book, Our Biometric Future, and these issues of surveillance that have formed important parts of your work for some time. How's that? What's that great expression people use? How's that going for you? I've had this funny experience where leaving California on a plane bound for Mexico, after you've gone through all the normal things, there's biometric surveillance, not coming from Mexico to the US.
There's not biometric surveillance coming from Mexico to the US. Yeah.
But there is the other way around, at least in the most recent times when I've done it quite a bit, between Mexico and California. And of course, it's completely inefficient. It's fucked. No one knows what they're doing. And in the end, they give up because the lines are huge. And this is at the gate as you're about to get on the plane. The last minute attempt to establish what you are fails hugely.
Well, I think that, maybe you're prodding me to say this. I don't know. But I always thought that it was a big failure. And I always thought that it was, in that book, started off as a smaller scale kind of project, as my dissertation project, which would be a look at this one effort to integrate facial recognition technology with a urban video surveillance system in Tampa, Florida. And then 9/11 happened. So that would kind of change things for me, but change the project. But that project was a failure. The one that I initially went to study, and I did end up studying it. It just ended up being a smaller, like just one component of a different study. But that project failed. It was a failure. They never successfully implemented facial recognition with closed circuit television system in that neighborhood. It's called Ybor City in Tampa. And I knew it was going to fail, kind of. I mean, even back then when I didn't, I was still just doing that research, it was like, this isn't going to work. I mean, there was a lot of reasons why. Maybe I was being influenced by Bruno Latour's book, Aramie, about the personal rapid transit system in France, which was a failure. Yeah, and I kind of wanted it to fail because I love that book. And I thought, this would be perfect. I want my dissertation to look like this.
I am Bruno Babe. Come watch me fly.
Well, not quite like that. But yeah, like I knew I wasn't going to be, and I abandoned all efforts to try to make the project look like that. But that book, which I think is a brilliant book. And I've read him, an interview with him where he identifies it as his favorite as well. So his own personal favorite. So anyway, I do think, okay, so the things that I in that book that I really didn't anticipate very well, because one can't know and predict the future, is how, cell phones, I'll put it that way. Like I didn't really anticipate how integrated the iPhone style cell phone, smartphone would become, in like how much of a prosthetic device that would become, and what a massive sort of change in human technology relationships that would introduce. I think at the time, did I even have a cell phone yet? It's hard for me to reconstruct that past. I did certainly eventually before the book was done, but But, you know, it, and so I do think there are ways that the that facial recognition ended up not being a failure, and biometrics is used in certain kinds of ways. With, but I'd still think of it as, yes, there has been, because of this massive use of it and increased sort of participation of everybody in making it better. You know, we all were habituated into helping make facial recognition technology work better. And without that enlistment of everybody in using it and ordered and improving it, then it, you know, and we had to be habituated, and there was very targeted and strategic ways of making us habituated into using it and helping to improve it. So, you know, it's not surprising to me that it continues to fail and continues to be, have these major, you know, it's not going to operate with perfect accuracy. And the invention of the accuracy of it was something that I was tuned into as well. So, and this, the, you know, the parallel argument is Donald McKenzie's book, Inventing Accuracy, about nuclear missile guidance systems, mm-hmm. and the way that the invention of the accuracy of nuclear missile guidance had to like happen alongside the invention of nuclear missile guidance. And that's exactly with facial recognition technology. Absolutely. The invention of its accuracy. There's so there, certainly at different moments, there was just so much attention to it's get, it is now 99.5% accurate. These studies show that it is 99.67% accurate, like just perpetual attention to its accuracy and how close to perfect it was working, according to these very limited studies, you know, that they were extrapolating from those studies that had major constraints on them to how accurate the technology was in the very, well, what computer scientists like to call the wild, in the wild, which just means their actual applications. So, to draw the connection between where I, that project about data centers, which is, and, or even my book that now that's in, you know, still in process. It's, the tentative title is The Avalanche of Video. It's the intervening kind of project was about video forensics. And so that field, which I saw kind of, and it has, that field has really exploded in the legal system as a field that is very, you know, it's just tasked with a lot. It's tasked with making, you know, evidentiary and epistemic use of video and doing so in a context in which video is massively proliferating and we are entering kind of the post-truth world, if we can use that term, a kind of, which I just see as sort of a massive fragmentation of media and audiences and experience. And, you know, everyone kind of living in their own algorithmically driven kind of worlds and being you know, there's all of this algorithmic radicalization of different groups happening. And so video forensics is like what I liked, as I used to refer to it as the post-production work that cops do with surveillance video. And that's what it was when I first started studying it. And that was the project right on the heels of that facial recognition technology book, because I had, you know, one thing that got left out of that book was this idea that facial recognition technology can corroborate eyewitness testimony. It can be this kind of definitive way of determining that people are, you know, that who people are, and it's better than humans, better than eyewitnesses, which has long been a huge problem. Eyewitness testimony is terrible. It's, you know, led to wrongful convictions and a systemic problem. And so not naturally needing, and even the legal system and the prosecutorial system recognizing a need to address that wrongful conviction problem. But anyway, when I started taking that route of saying, okay, how is facial recognition technology being used in this very kind of constrained context? I discovered this field that is a video forensics, which goes beyond facial recognition and is looking at a lot of, you know, how to make, how to turn raw video into usable evidence, initially from video surveillance systems, but then from an avalanche of video coming from cell phone video for vernacular uses, also police body cam video, drone footage, you name it. Like, there's so many sources of video now. Mm-hmm. And that all happened to that field as I was trying to like understand what was happening in that field. So yeah, I'm wanting to shift a little bit my focus from surveillance to a kind of, you know, I want to, so I, the way I would put it is in a kind of log line is like from surveillance to sustainability, or, you know, trying to understand, and I'm much, because I feel like this question of that you and Rick Maxwell get at so well between media and the environmental crisis, that just seems to like grab me more now. And so I'm shifting direction in that way, but there's also a sense in which after what happened with video forensics turned into a very highly, how can I put this? Body cam video in particular, what happened there was that once the field, the group of community of people that I was studying that were doing this video forensics work were confronted with the fact that they were going to be having to deal with body cam video, I turned my attention in that direction of police body cam video, and it became very obvious that very quickly that police adoption of body cameras was going to push police IT systems onto cloud computing services. And that represented a major tech industry capture of the bureaucratic systems of the criminal legal system. Mm-hmm. Okay. And that this was not, I think some people are recognizing that now, but that kind of platformization or the transformation of policing into these kind of platform driven systems was a shift that, you know, really was unavoidable to see. And that was what I, just going back to what I was saying about the tech industry being a bigger problem to me than policing. I feel like these body cam systems are, you know, an avenue for extracting revenues from cities, and not just in the sale of the systems, but in the management of the platforms that are required to manage that scale of video. So I don't know, these are meandering, you know, our intellectual routes are always meandering, or what our interest in and what we're focusing on, and just sort of following the actors often, trying to do that, what I'm, you know, to borrow an actor network theory idea, but I just borrow that. I don't stay there because I don't just want to follow the actors. I want to have my own informed critique and argument of what I see happening. But yeah, I'm really very interested in the tech industry and its power in our, at this moment, and this kind of conjuncture of, you know, media technological conditions and sociopolitical ones. That's the large.
I want to bring us forward from that wonderful book, as you've just done, to talk about a fairly recent essay of yours that was published about the January 6, 2021 temporary occupation of the Capitol by amateur fascists. And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about that, because this is a case where definitely body cameras attached to police officers and artisanal video taken by loser fascists and some footage from the bourgeois media, you can see that I'm a value-free thinker on this, merged to produce a body of knowledge in some sense.
So I, one of the things I've, as I've been paying attention to media forensics and that, you know, phenomenon, which is shifting and changing, along with media technological change, and also in response to this kind of fragmentation of the media and public sphere, I was, you know, I am also very much interested in how video forensics can be, you know, media forensics can be used not necessarily by police users or by the prosecutorial system and the state to a kind of what Yale Weissman calls counter forensics, or a kind of, you know, these other, alongside that, this is happening, right? That for I was starting to see and hear when I would go to conference, like my orientation to media forensics was very much like, oh, this is a prosecutorial technology. But for a lot of people, it was not. And it was being used certainly by like forensic architecture group and, you know, organizations like Bellingcat to kind of point to track state crimes and corporate crimes with open source materials and sources readily available online, whether it's video or other forms of other data. And so I was, you know, wanting to pay attention to that. And then, of course, the New York Times decides to, you know, put in place this visual investigations team, and they start doing really interesting work at the Times and producing these really highly produced forensic reports of very as a kind of form of video journalism, a form of journalism. And that was really interesting to me. The first one that I saw that really caught my attention, although I don't see this particular example as kind of a count of example of counter forensics along the what the lines of what forensic architecture does, but it was about the Las Vegas shooting, mass shooting that happened in Las Vegas. And you know, there was a country music festival happening, and somebody, you know, broke went checked into a casino hotel, the Mandalay Bay Hotel, and then shot up the crowd. It was a pretty horrible and major mass shooting. And casinos are like the most heavily surveilled spaces. They're completely covered with surveillance cameras and secure, very, you know, security aimed at a lot of it aimed at, you know, preventing the kinds of crimes that, you know, ca card counting that they see as crimes, but also that sort of thing, like fraud. Casino, gambling fraud, just managing the whatever is happening on the casino floor very closely. And Natasha Delschulp's book has some really interesting insights of little vignettes about this, but about casino security and what how it is repurposed in other for other things than just security or what we would think of as security. So anyway, that piece was really interesting because they were able to. The team at the New York Times was able to piece back together that shooter's life, and for they did it for a week. Every you know every coming and going of from into the casino, he built up his arsenal for about a week, enlisting the help of the you know the bellhops. I mean, they were carrying his suitcases full of weapons up to his rooms, his big giant suite for him, and. It was just so interesting to me that, and they were also able to get obviously his cell phone data because they tracked his movements as he left the, you know, the camera, the circumference of the cameras, tracked his movements back and forth. He was going home and going to another site that he was supposedly checking out, scoping out. So, I realized that, wow, this is like a real opportunity for video journalists if they're going to get a hold of these kinds of materials be able to access, which really don't count as open sources. I mean, video casino footage is not open source. You have to have special access. You probably need lawyers often to get that. They're not just going to hand it over to you. It's always been the case that casinos have been these labs for the development of surveillance technologies and what is possible with surveillance that are done entirely outside of any kind of, you know, public access. It was just very stunning to me that they were able to do that. They've done a lot of different pieces since then. And a lot of it is about trying to expose state violence and state misinformation and disinformation campaigns. And so that really got me interested in that group. And this video forensics and its application as a form of forensic journalism, and the kind of alignments between forensic epistemology and journalism as a form of public knowledge, that I think it has great potential and also I'm very like wary of in some ways as well, just because I'm not, my pathway into learning about video forensics and understanding what it is through the police. It's, you know, and even E.L. Weissman calls it the art of the police. Forensics is the art of the police, and really wants to situate what they're doing is something very different. And it is very different. So yeah, that article was sort of something I wrote because of how dramatic that particular example that I write about was, the Capitol riot report, forensic report that they produced. Mm-hmm. I seem to think was a very special case. Relatively speaking, it was the longest one that they had produced to date. They may have produced lengthier pieces like that since then, but, they were usually producing these kind of 5 to 10 minute video pieces, whereas this one was 40 minutes, and it was pretty extensive in the amount of the material that they assembled to reconstruct that story in a particular way, but to try to, you know, reassemble what was happening at different locations and unfolding over time in on that fateful day, January 6th, which interestingly, I've heard again and again, people, not academic folk types, but my contact with the outside world, where people in the US, for some people, I've heard more than once them say that January 6th was worse than 9/11 for them in terms of how traumatized they were by it. Which I just think is a very interesting statement, I don't remember being that particularly traumatized by it. It doesn't really compare to the kind of impact that I recall way back on 9/11 and what happened in, you know, afterwards. But it's interesting that some people are experiencing that way and articulating it that way. And so it's a significant event. And you know, the idea that somehow you could tell a definitive story about it and that that would stick and that that's their goal, the visual investigations team, which I think is just, I applaud them for trying to do something like that. But I also think they're fighting a losing battle because of audience fragmentation, because of the way we are all so algorithmically, differentiated. And we don't live in the same mediated realities at all.
Prof, I wonder if I could ask you a couple more questions and then throw it to you to add anything you wish to what we've discussed as a way of concluding. Does that sound all right?
Sure.
So first question is, as if I were the Committee on Academic Personnel at the University of California,
no.
The dreaded CAP, and I'm a botanist, I'm a geologist, I'm an economist, and I'm saying, how the fuck does she know all this?
They wouldn't be so mean.
Oh, sorry. I'm unclear as to Professor Gates' method.
I have to say that my current department chair is a former CAP person. Other colleagues have served on CAP. They're okay people often. CAP is the Committee on Academic Personnel, this kind of, star chamber sort of feeling thing at UCSC. How do I know all of it? It depends. How do I know all of this about the forensic journalism is by watching it online. I didn't even interview anybody at the Times. Malachi Brown, who is sort of their leader, that kind of leads that team and is also often the director of the various pieces, and he's one of the directors of the Day of Rage, which is the title of that piece we were just talking about. He gave a lot of podcast interviews, so I listened to those, and those podcasters asked great questions, and I might have asked additional questions or other questions, but I worked with that, and it was fine with me. I feel like I got a lot of, what he would be willing to say, he said to them. I don't think he would have given me more, and I'm not like some massively skilled, interviewer, ethnographer. So I got that information from, I'm pretty clear about knowing it that. When it comes to other things like, my methods, if that's what you're asking. Is that what you're asking about my
Yeah.
method? Okay. So, the video forensic stuff, I went to video forensics training. It was an interesting experience because they didn't know what to make of me, but they thought maybe I was. There were a few people, like one guy said to me, "You're studying us like we're guinea pigs, aren't you?" I was like, you get it. And then the others thought I was sort of there to find, learn about it so I could start up a similar kind of, training program at UCSD, whatever. Like they didn't, and it so that felt a little weird because I was like, it's not what I'm doing, but I went to that and I conducted interviews with some people. I also went for the book that about video forensics and to learn more about body cam video, I actually went to body cam video systems, I should say, body cameras. I went to a series of events hosted by the company Taser, which became Axon, that at first were free. And I asked if I could come, and they're like, sure. And then cost money, so had to pay. Because they started hosting these big conferences, and they were like, at first they were sort of these publicity events to try to get police chiefs and other police decision makers on board, and they would bring people to their headquarters, which was a whole experience. And they would have former police chiefs talking about adopting body cameras and all of that. So that all of their generosity in allowing me to come to those events was really like amazing, because I learned a lot there. By the time people were paying for it, I mean, I wasn't the only subversive one in the group, like in the room. There were and that's a okay. And then there were so there were like people who were journalists and others there. I met somebody at one of those groups, one of those I'm sorry, one of those events that was studying. Like data, he was a researcher who studies data recovery. And he, I mean, that was what he provided me with a lot of help understanding that things like redaction and how useless they are, other than as a kind of very public facing sort of, technology. I mean, so that, how else do I know? The data centers thing, I feel like with the data center stuff, there is a lot of wealth of information online that I can access, a screened based. I'm using the internet as well, to learn about that. But I feel like because because I have this familial connection to the place, my in-laws are settlers there. I've seen it. I've
Mm-hmm.
I've seen it in a firsthand sense, and I've seen, you know, not just the buildings going up everywhere, which is enough to be impressed by or, you know, depressed by, but also the signage and the, you know, and hearing people's talking about it, including my in-laws who are, you know, really unhappy about it. And then, yeah, you know, I have a whole set of ways of cobbling together this work.
I'm satisfied. I'm satisfied, Prof. The botanist, geologist, economist is now saying, I get it.
Okay.
Analysis, participant observation, political economy.
Yes, thank you. That's great. Thank you for summarizing that. It's funny because I want to tell a quick anecdote here, if there's time. Now one of my colleagues always notes this. I'm hearing it secondhand, but apparently she was in conversation with some non-social science, non-humanities types at the UCSD, you know, one of these major campus-wide committee settings. And someone said, you know, there are whole departments in the social sciences and humanities that don't do research. And my colleague was like, really? Which ones are those? And she proceeded to rattle off all the departments that don't have major research grants. So she was basically just equating research with research grants. And if you didn't have research grants, that meant you weren't doing research. So that was kind of, you know, telling of how the Committee on Academic Personnel, how they have to be educated when they have to review files from the social sciences and humanities, it's very important that there be a representative who can educate them.
Well, I have a story for you on that score. When I was on a review committee for the University of California, San Diego, and in fact, in your department, but I think probably before you went there, one of the members of the committee was from the most distinguished science bit of UCSD. And he wanted to be involved because he said, and he was a wonderful member of the committee, but afterwards he said, you know, where I work, everybody hates one another. It's incredibly poisonous and awful. And when I come to the rest of the campus, I meet real people. So,
okay.
My last question for you, Prof, before I throw to you to conclude things for us, is to ask you what you think about big data as the answer to everything. And let me give a quick background to this, why I think it seems to be given as such. When you look at the state of journalism, very difficult, troubling situation today in the United States and in other, in inverted commas, wealthy countries, and journalism schools, vast resources are being dedicated to making everybody become a visualizer of data. And to the idea that if people can become literate, in inverted commas, or numerate in big data, then more useful and accurate knowledge will become available.
Mm-hmm.
I was on another external review committee for a big university in Hong Kong a few years ago, and the pressure from some but not all US members of the external review committee was to get rid of public opinion polling from the syllabus and from the service of the university, a service that had been extremely lucrative and still was, and dump all that money into big data training for students and provision of services to the outside world. So I just wondered where that seems to figure in this domain that you've sketched for us.
Well, okay, so I'm just like, big data as the answer to everything. I think big data is the problem to everything. So, it wouldn't be as much of a problem if it wasn't so like ideologically celebrated without any like questioning it is somehow questioning the sort of elevation of data science institutes and everything else as like the at the forefront of everything and the most important centers, and where all the it's just capturing the talent, you know, the bright young minds. It's, you know, where all the money goes. I mean, that to me is just an enormous problem. And I'm waiting, and maybe I'm just not looking in the right place. And I would love to get some suggestions. I feel like the very close connections between big data, computational hegemony, is how imbricated it is with finance capitalism, and how important it is to finance capitalism, needs to be better understood and fleshed out so that we can really see why it's the problem as opposed to the answer. I do think, you know, this idea that it's AI now, that's the new term, that the acronym that's, you know, replacing big data mostly as somehow going to, you know, solve all the medical problems, solve all the problems of scale, when it's creating so many problems. And the scale of it and the scale that it requires is creating a massive problem. I mean, the fact that these computing infrastructures that are outfitted for AI are requiring, you know, coal-fired power plants in West Virginia to abandon their plans to shutter is evidence enough. I mean, there's a huge problem here, and that most of what I would suspect, going back to this project of the data center expansion, a lot of that is overproduction. Possibly. I mean, this is not, you know, this is my speculation, but it's, you know, it's going to be abandoned infrastructure, and or quite possibly be just massive abandoned infrastructure. And if big data is big data going to be the answer to that? I mean, I saw someone come into the science studies colloquium we have here at UCSD from the Scripps, the Institute of Oceanography. And she was talking about these sensors that are distributed all over the ocean to measure all kinds of ocean data. And that for some people, or I don't know exactly who, I can't remember now, but there's an interest in creating a complete replication of the ocean as data so that it can be studied. And so that the impacts of climate change on the ocean can be studied. Without any consideration of what a complete replica of data, the amount of energy and infrastructure it would require to create a replica of the ocean. And there's always these nods to technology will advance and this will all be, all these problems of, you know, will be these renewable, we'll have renewable energy sources that are fueling the data centers. That's always deferred into the future at some hopeful future moment that will, you know, my being my cynical self is pretty sure will never arrive. So that's my answer to big data as the answer to everything. That it's going to, you know, make more useful knowledge available to us. I'm not convinced. I'm far from convinced. In fact, I'm the opposite of convinced oftentimes. I'm a Luddite at heart, I guess, but, you know,
in true the best son of Leicester. I mean, not real, but meant to be the true son of Leicester. Prof, to conclude, I wonder if there are things that we've touched on that you'd like to elaborate upon further, or issues where we haven't visited and where you'd like to add something.
That's a good question. There's lots of things, but sorry, I'm going to pause here for a second. I didn't think fast about this.
Pausing is fine.
What's that?
Pausing is fine. We can do station identification.
Okay, good. What's the station identification? That's interesting.
This is the Cultural Studies podcast.
Okay. So I think that one of the reasons why I like, okay, can I just say something? Can I be like really almost, I want to, I'm a first generation to go to college person, and that I have a certain background that kind of pushes me in these directions that I don't always, we don't always think as, I hide it maybe, or I don't always think as relevant, certainly as relevant to everything, but how to draw all those connections. And so I think it's interesting to think about that. I mean, I saw a talk just on Monday where someone was from another person from Scripps Institute of Oceanography who gave this really interesting talk, you know, and is a kind of subversive scientist. Was really interesting. But he started off by, you know, addressing kind of the land acknowledgement problem, and or the problem in the sense of, you know, the problems with these kind of nods to land acknowledgments. And the answer is that some people are giving is sort of, what is your connection to what he said to do is to address your connection to the land. And I thought about that. I guess I've just been thinking about that as I am, how am I connected to the land? Because we all feel, I mean, I feel really disconnected. I feel like a, you know, such a mobile person. You know, I have a partner who lives in another city. I spend a lot of time on airplanes, having a huge carbon footprint. I live in a place now in Southern California that, you know, isn't my place of origin. I grew up in, you know, Pittsburgh, and the, you know, all of my grandfathers, I had three of them, three sets of grandparents worked in steel mills and were, you know, my economic migrants from Poland and Ireland. Like, you know, I'm kind of, would that, I think I'm second generation. I don't know. So I feel like these concerns are what make me want to look at something like, you know, having seen the imprint of the steel industry and the abandoned steel infrastructure, and that being my place of where I grew up, makes me look at something like the abandoned, or just envision abandoned infrastructure of data centers, or just even seeing this moment of expansion. Like, how do we capture this moment for memory, you know, for our memories? And that's, I think that's why I'm really interested in the visualization of it and the way drone photography is used to try to capture it, and what will happen to all those images, and whether we'll be able to kind of use those images to sort of say, to make an argument that will prevent these problems from recurring, which is way too hopeful because it just never stops, this sort of cyclical, and it seemingly growing in scale sort of way that these things repeat themselves. But yeah, you know, I've been thinking about the kind of way that I can be fully informed and even maybe just self-aware of why I've taken these directions, and kind of get back to my own sort of first principles about what is important to me, important, and what I want to, you know, what I want to say. So I don't know. That's not very well developed thought to
No, very
conclude.
well. And I just, it's very generous of you to tell us about that personal story. And I think it's very important because for people who aren't familiar with Pittsburgh and its story, in addition to having been this steel mill place, it has been the model for the so-called regeneration of so-called Rust Belt places, an awful and offensive term, through the dread hand of Richard Florida, who currently is charging between 50 and 70,000 bucks an hour to give a lecture to thousands of people. The price has gone up from 30 to 40,000 bucks, which was the last time I looked. And it's all about investing in software development going back to the 80s. And so this is this notion of Pittsburgh as the model for creative industries is not only very significant and in some ways painful and redolent of transformation for you, it's actually something that is relevant to the whole world because it's amazing how Prof. Florida's 70,000 bucks an hour advice has taken Pittsburgh as the model for the whole of the world.
Well, I'll just end with then a bumper sticker that you will see on cars in Pittsburgh, and it says, "Keep Pittsburgh shitty." So
go Steelers. Well,
yeah, that vibe there.
Cultural studies scholar Kelly Gates, thank you so much for being with us. As I think I indicated earlier when we started, every time, every conversation I've ever had with you, even when we were riding bikes, or in my case, bikes, and you're worried about helmet hair around LA, every conversation I've had with you, other than where do we turn right? What do you mean we turn left? Has been productive and exciting for me. I learned so much from you. And in recent years, that's been exclusively really from your written work, which is always crisp, clear, and brilliant. So thank you so much for being with us today and enriching the life of so many of your readers and no doubt your students too.
Oh, well, Toby, thank you for having me. This is so fun, actually. And I appreciate you so much in this podcast and all of your work. So continues to really inform at a fundamental level what, you know, what my trajectories are. So thank you.